For almost 2,000 years, the Catholic Church has pointed the way toward salvation through Jesus Christ. For each of us, that journey starts in darkness, as if in a cave. We invite you now to come with us as we seek wisdom and truth by way of faith and reason with your guides, Mark Tuttle and Timothy O'Donnell. Join us in the Catholic Cave.
Welcome once again to the Catholic Cave. Caves, plural. I'm Kent Blanford in my cave,
yes.
Southside. We've got Timothy O'Donnell in his cave, although his walls are lined with books. And then we've got Mark Tuttle over in his cave, and, you know, he's trying to hide out from the rest of the family, I think.
Yeah. Keep the noise to a minimum, exactly.
All right. Guys, life has changed. Obviously, life has changed in the past few weeks. Changes are coming. More changes. We've got, you know, maybe vaccines down the line. We've got, you know, tracking that we need to do to find out who's been vaccinated, who's been exposed, these kinds of things. What are the moral and ethical dilemmas that we are likely going to face as a result of COVID-19?
Well, I think there's a bunch. And, you know, this really opens up the door to a conversation around what we normally call bioethics. You know, bio referring to biology, and then ethics, of course, sort of right conduct. So let's spend a little time here in the caves today to talk a little bit, Mark, about Catholic bioethics. And yep. maybe a way for us to get at that, what I was thinking is maybe we could begin with sort of taking stock of where we're at in terms of, say, something like something that's always, it's interesting to me, are things like the intersection of the human body with advanced technology, and the human body in terms of, say, enhancements, even if they're done for, whether they're restorative, for advancement, or even aesthetics. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I think there's a whole public health realm of ethics, because, you know, we keep talking about this as a medical type of crisis, but there's a distinction between medicine and public health. And I think there's a lot of ethical questions that come into play when you're looking at, you know, what can we do to keep a virus from infecting the whole body politic. But that means that you're essentially kind of maybe harming healthy people for the sake of trying to help keep people from getting sick. And so that whole maxim that medicine is built around of first do no harm, you begin to question, well, what are the limits of that? So I think there's a whole lot of ethical questions even around just the whole notion of public health.
Yeah, I think one of the things that comes to mind philosophically is it brings to mind there's a lot of different goods, basic human goods that have to be kept in view and balanced. One of which, though, that we in the current sense, especially Americans, we are very, very fond of, and for good reason, of our autonomy. We often give primacy of place when we think of priorities. We think of the human person, our autonomy, meaning our ability as that we're individuals, that we're acting agents, and that we want to maximize our freedom of choice. And so that's often we think, well, what's good? Well, what's good is kind of that people are left to choose whatever they want to do. And as long as they're not, quote unquote, harming someone else, we ought to basically leave them alone. And that, of course, obscures many or leaves behind or sets aside many other important ethical considerations. But that's kind of so when going back to where you were starting to point us, Mark, when it comes to, say, something, let's talk about vaccines. That comes up in all kinds of Catholic circles all the time. I see it on social media all the time. When we think about vaccines, what are some of the ethical considerations that arise when you think of vaccines and vaccinations?
Well, I think the very, very basic fact about a vaccine is that you're giving it to a healthy person. So this is a medical intervention on a perfectly healthy person, which any and all vaccines, there's a small, slight, tiny chance of causing that person harm. So you're taking a healthy person, you're risking doing something that might potentially be harmful to that person for the sake of the greater good. And, you know, especially when you look at the historical ethics around medicine, just medical ethics, you know, the first maxim of medicine is first to do no harm. And so, you know, when you look at it from a medical perspective, it would almost seem to, you know, vaccines would seem to go in the face of that idea, that you're taking a healthy person, you're doing something to them that might cause them harm for the sake of keeping other people healthy. And so I think there's a slight ethical question with that. Obviously, we crossed that bridge a long time ago. We've been giving vaccines for over 100 years now. And, you know, so I think we've as a society have said, well, that's okay. But then the question is, how far do you take that? How far do you take this notion that you can do somebody harm for the sake of the body politic? And now we've moved in with this quarantine, we've moved into a realm of not just physical harm, but now we're talking about social harms. You know, we're talking about keeping people away from family, we're talking about keeping people away from friends, from work, from society. And, you know, there's a whole bunch of ethical questions to be raised around that.
Yeah, it seems in the current setting at the time that we're having this discussion, yeah, there are severe protocols in place to limit one's movement and freedom and ability to interact with other people in person, and that's very pervasive. Going back to like vaccines, I know certainly with the current Wuhan virus, there's many good people, talented people that have been mobilized seeking a vaccine designed to prevent, as you said, the spread of the contagion. And it can be vaccines also, you know, are designed to protect the person themselves, but also the other people too. And so there definitely is a common good that one is after. But one of the things that's come up with vaccines, even prior to our current setting, or the current pursuit for the Wuhan virus is a vaccine for that, is where are scientists sort of getting the biological material from in order to develop those lines of cells in order to, again, experiment on them in order to develop an effective vaccine. That's been a cause of ethical concern for some time, because other vaccines, and here I could be wrong, the listing of them at least, but other well-known vaccines have been known or proven to have a heritage or a lineage that traces them back to cells that were derived from or acquired from aborted children. And that raises, not certainly for Catholics, but I think anyone who is interested in justice and then also natural law would find that highly problematic, to use tissue, say, from a human being that's unjustly killed, and then deriving therapies or pursuing other goods using their dead bodies.
Right, right. And, you know, the ethics around that are a little bit different from where in that process you fit. So if you're a normal person that you're going to have your family vaccinated, and the only vaccine that's available was derived from a vaccine that they used aborted fetal tissue in the development of it, you know, that puts you at a pretty remote distance. But now with the development of a new
and that was from decades ago.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. Those were decades ago. Say it was chickenpox as an example.
Maybe. But now, that might now be with, one. Right, right. But now with the development of a new vaccine, now you've got the opportunity to not use something unethical in the development of it. And you've got, you know, ways to go about, but guess what? It's a little bit more expensive. It's a little bit more difficult. It's going to slow the process down. And so, you know, I think there's pressure to take the easy route, even if it was using aborted fetal tissue, to develop this vaccine. So there was a petition that went out a little while ago. Some of our listeners may want to kind of seek this out and sign on to it, urging the Trump administration to ensure that whatever vaccine research is being funded by the federal government for this is ethical, and it's not using elements and parts of the vaccine that were originally from aborted fetal tissue.
Yeah, that's been a unfortunately, that's been a bit of a political football. No, I remember that President Bush had done a good job of at least restricting some of these aborted fetal lines to at least no new ones could be opened up. And I think there were something like 7 or 10 of them that were in current use, but at least they couldn't open on, start any new ones. The Obama administration, you know, set all that aside, and it was, you know, wild, wild west for that horrible practice, unethical practice. And then Trump tightened it back up again. So yeah, let's hope that's morally wrong, because it violates a very basic principle that I think we're all familiar with, which is that the end doesn't justify the means, meaning that the end in this case, you know, finding a vaccine that would, that would help many, many, potentially millions and millions of people from getting very sick or even dying. We can't use any means or any way or any method to how we get there is a critical ethical consideration. We can't just get to desired outcomes any old way we want. There are some ways are not permitted, and it's not permitted, I would say, under Catholic moral philosophy, Catholic moral theology, as well as appeals to justice and natural law, to use, again, the remains of people who were killed and murdered in order to get that raw material. It does a lot of things, and not the least of which, this is also why it could incentivize those practices. And this is why, for example, it's illegal in the United States and most other countries, it's illegal to traffic in human body parts, right? It's illegal. Why? Because it would incentivize people potentially to what? Not to steal dead bodies, but create dead bodies that you can sell, you know? Right. You commercialize it, right? Yep. And well, we know that when you make things legal, you get more of it.
Yep. Well, Tim, we're coming up on a break. You know, we've talked about how developing the vaccines using aborted fetal tissue is immoral. When we come back from the break, let's talk a little bit about, on the using end, is it immoral to receive a vaccine that's been developed from aborted fetal tissue?
And we'll be back with more of the Catholic Cave right after this.
Alexa, what's the weather forecast for today?
Alexa, what time is the Colts game today?
Alexa, remind me to pick up the dry cleaning tomorrow.
Has Alexa become a part of your daily routine? Then make sure that routine includes Alexa, play Catholic Radio Indy.
Catholic Radio Indy.
Quick, easy access to Catholic programming 24/7. Just say, Alexa, play Catholic Radio Indy.
Catholic Radio Indy.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle here with Timothy O'Donnell and with Kent Blanford. Well, maybe not exactly here. I'm here. Tim, you're over there. Kent, you're right. Over there. But,
right.
But through the beauties of technology, we're all still able to converse and have the cave. And we were just talking about biomedical technology, particularly vaccines. And there is a race on to try to find a vaccine for this coronavirus. And the question came up about, you know, this vaccine very likely or potentially is being derived from the remains of aborted children, making and creating a vaccine using the remains of a person who was killed in utero is highly immoral. That I think any Catholic can see, and really any person of goodwill to a certain extent can see that. But then there comes a complicated question. If a vaccine is made and it was derived from aborted fetal tissue, are we as Catholics obligated to not allow ourselves to be vaccinated using this vaccine?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think there's a few considerations. The first one, and this will maybe seem obvious, is there an ethical alternative? So if there's an ethical alternative, in other words, if there's a couple of different vaccines or that maybe it's ultimately the same vaccine but produced or developed two different ways, then we ought to, if it's within our means, we ought to pursue the ethical alternative. And that's true not just for vaccines, but anything else that may have a unethical sort of taint to it, shall we say. That's one, but an alternative may not be available. Then what one has to do is, I think, so does one take the vaccine? Well, the answer you have to weigh out, I think, or some of the factors to consider would be, one, and this is what you brought up, I think, earlier, Mark, which is, what's the health risk that I am assuming when I take it? In other words, based on my own health conditions, age, pre-existing conditions, et cetera, how risky is it for me to take this particular vaccine? As we know, some vaccines are more problematic, riskier for some people at different stages of life than others. So that would be number one. What's the risk to me? Number two is, I have to have a view to my family and others and the common good. In other words, what are the costs if I forego this vaccine? What are the implications for other people that I live with, or I come in close contact with? When we know this particular virus is highly communicable, it's highly contagious. We know it does cause death in some instances. What if it were more deadly, for example, or created far worse symptoms like a smallpox? You know, would it be ethical to refuse assuming that it's not an undue health risk to yourself, would it be ethical to refuse, say, taking a smallpox vaccine, knowing that smallpox is, you're likely to get exposed, to smallpox, contract it yourself or give it to someone else? Smallpox is a horrible, horrible disease, whether the high mortality rate, but even if you don't die from smallpox, it causes the individual a tremendous amount of suffering and scarring from the pox themselves. So it's a horrible, horrible disease. So those are the things. So the one thing that's maybe a little bit different about our current setting with the Wuhan virus is it seems to be, based on news reports that I've heard, follow, and tend to trust and find credible, it seems as if the virus being highly contagious is also all around us to a certain extent. It's likely that one might come in contact with it by virtue of being near other people. That wouldn't be the case if I were, it wouldn't be the same situation, for example, again, going back to smallpox, if I weren't vaccinated right now for smallpox, it's highly unlikely I'm gonna come in contact with anyone that has smallpox. So it may not be very consequential. When it comes to the current Wu flu, well, guess what? It seems like lots of people have it. And so it's highly likely that I would pick it up at some point and then become a carrier, either become sick myself or become a carrier and put other people's health at risk. So those are some of the considerations. What do you think?
Well, I think there's a really important element to Catholic moral philosophy that the the outside world tends to reject and neglect. And that is, Catholic moral teaching starts from the standpoint of we are social animals. You know, that's Aristotle's maxim. We are political animals. We are made to be built and to live within community. And so that brings a responsive set of responsibilities and obligations right off the bat for us to be looking after other people's welfare around us. To the extent that, you know, we should be in a lot of ways looking after other people's welfare before we're looking after our own welfare. Granted, you know, there's a little bit of a balancing act. There's a little bit of a calculus involved of, how much am I putting myself at risk versus, you know, not putting other people at risk. But by and large, you know, I think there is a moral obligation to do what is going to be best for the common good, to do what is going to be best for those around us, even if to a certain extent we're sacrificing our own health, our own rights, our own situation for the sake of others.
Yeah, I definitely see where you're going with the obligation, duty to pursue and contribute to the common good, because you're right. We live in social settings, and that's absolutely the case. I think though, also though, where we don't want to go, and I'm no way suggesting you're saying this, Mark, because I know you well enough that you're not. But just for our listeners' sake, there is a point where you go too far, where we can go too far with upholding the common good, because the balance that in political philosophy that has to be struck, or not balance, but a prioritization, is there's two main actors in the political field. There's the state with a capital S, meaning the government, and then there's the person or individual. And where totalitarian regimes, what they're known for is the top priority is the state and the state's goals, and then subordinated to it or second priority is consideration for the person or the individual. One of the things that we would say is part of Catholic social teaching, it's also part of the American heritage that we have, is that actually the person should be the top priority and the state should be subordinated to it. So, but that doesn't mean they're both not important, but we don't want the state, and this is coming up increasingly, this might be a little preview for next week's show, but increasingly there's a lot of talk and concern about the shelter in place, the quarantine, the various protocols, guidelines, and restrictions that are currently happening locally at the county level, with businesses, at the state level, federal level, that are raising some serious concerns by sober and intelligent people who care about individual liberty. But next week we're going to focus more on that. I want to get back to this, and I want to put you on the spot, Mark. Okay, so let's think about this. Okay, let's say tomorrow Big Pharma comes out and there's a Wu flu vaccine. Are you going to take it?
Well, you know, as you said, there are some considerations. If it is as safe as most of the other vaccines that are out there, and if it has been ethically derived, then I don't think there's really any question. Yes, you're kind of, you know, all else being equal, I think you're under kind of an obligation to receive a vaccine in order to protect the health of those around you, protect the health of your family, the community, etc. But I think that definitiveness starts to become a little less definitive when you start adding in other factors. Was this derived in an unethical way? Well, you know, then to what extent am I contributing to the continued production of vaccines? Obviously, you don't want to do that. So are there ways that I can avoid that? How does that weigh against the evil of allowing this thing to continue to spread? You've got to think about that and consider that. You know, I think you also have a little bit of a question of how is it being administered to the public? Is this a diktat and a demand that's coming down from the state where it's going to be illegal for people to resist. In which case, then there might be a little bit of an obligation to kind of think through that. So how it's being administered kind of factors in. So there's a lot of little factors that kind of mitigate that initial certainty of, yes, by all means, you're almost obligated to do something like this. But I think, you know, in the real world, given most factors, they come out with a vaccine tomorrow. Yeah, I think you take it. And I think most people really ought to.
Yeah, I hear where you're coming from. I think I'm like-minded on that. The one of the things is I've entered into some conversations around the development of a vaccine for the current virus that we're contending with. There does seem to be some concern about what you were just touching on, which is, will it be mandatory? And if it's not mandatory, say up to, you know, it could be up to including say fines or imprisonment or something like that. But what if it's just simply more along the lines of you have to have some sort of documentation or otherwise some sort of credible source that says you have been vaccinated, so that therefore you're quote unquote safe to be around other people, say outside your home. Let's think about that for a second, because we're coming up on a break. I mean, we get to the other side of the break. Let's pick that up and let's think about what might be some of the ramifications of a few different types of scenarios where vaccines move from just something on a wish list or to something that may take the form of something mandatory.
All right, and we'll be back to explore those options and those possibilities right after this. You're listening to The Catholic Cave on Catholic Radio Indy.
Have you ever thought about joining the Catholic Church? Have you just wanted to explore the Catholic faith? All you need to do is call your local Catholic Church for more information. We are always happy to help you in your journey to discover and learn more about the Catholic faith. We have classes that are almost year-round, and the classes and information sessions do not involve making a commitment, and there is no pressure to join. Please call your local Catholic parish for more information today and start the journey of one day possibly becoming Catholic as well. God bless.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave, or caves. There's at least three of them out there. I'm in one, Mark's in one, Kent's in another. And we've been talking bioethics and kind of contending a little bit with some thoughts around and considerations of the current pandemic, vaccines and things of that nature. Before the break, Mark, I was bringing up this, and I'm going to ask you to see if you'd share a little bit more specifically from a Catholic philosophical perspective, which is this. What would be important for Catholics to be thinking about from, say, a first principles or relevant principles basis when it comes to, say something where there's mandatory, there's some sort of mandatory requirement to have been vaccinated against, say, the Wu flu, the Wuhan virus, the COVID-19, or you're going to be prevented from either certain social gatherings, access to different commercial activities like different stores, schools. Maybe you wouldn't be allowed if you're a student, you wouldn't be allowed entry into a classroom or something like that. What should we be thinking about? Because this stuff is getting mulled over as we're increasingly looking forward to a kind of de-escalation from the kind of lockdown that we're currently in.
Yeah, I think there's some really good tools at our disposal as Catholics from the Catholic philosophical tradition of looking at these things. And you mentioned, I think, one of the first and foremost, and that is the preservation of the dignity of the human individual. That has always been a hallmark of Catholic social teaching and Catholic ethics, that the dignity of the person has to be held intact. So if you're looking at restrictions, or you're looking at isolation, or you're looking at some form of I guess even punishment for not getting yourself vaccinated, that is going to be a violation of human dignity. That should be a huge concern for Catholics. On the other hand, another important principle is regard for the common good. So we have to be on the lookout for what is going to be not just good for me and not just good for myself. Sure, what's going to be best for me is that I have complete liberty to go wherever I want, whenever I want, however I want, without interference. That's going to be best for me, but that may not be best for the common good. And so the dignity of the human person has to be kept intact, but at the same time, the common good has to be promoted. So what do we do as Catholics when those seemingly come into contradiction? Well, we get an extra tool at our disposal, and that is the tool of subsidiarity. And what subsidiarity says is basically decisions like this need to be made at the most local, most closest to the actual root of the problem level as possible. So those decisions need to be left to, and the administration of that needs to be left to families, communities, cities, and not, I think, when you get much beyond that, and you've got the instruments of, federal power and state power kind of grinding these things out, I think that's when you're going to wind up with human dignity being stomped on, and even the common good being violated. In the name of trying to come up with a policy that sort of one size fits all. So we've got three very solid tools to use as Catholics to kind of argue for a sane, reasonable policy, I guess, for how we come out of our current quarantine.
Do you feel that what's your assessment of our ability as a country to put some of those principles to work?
Well, I think, I think we have to give our public officials the benefit of the doubt that they are going to listen to the public. So as we raise these concerns in a constructive way, as we bring them to our politicians' attention, I think they're listening, and I feel like, they're hearing these concerns, and they're keeping them in the back of their minds as they're coming up with policy. So I do feel that, if something does come down the pike that is hugely burdensome, this country has a great tradition of civil disobedience, of peaceful regress against the authorities. So, I think we're kind of in a good position that, if for some reason something comes down the pike that is tyrannous, we as a people are able to handle this, and we've got a political culture and a political climate to be able to address it.
One I think possible, maybe not saying necessarily probable, maybe it's moving towards being more probable than not, is there's talk, there's some talk in the news, just recently, just yesterday even. A little more today about setting up, again, focusing on the infectious, contagious nature of the current virus, the fact that one can be a carrier of it and be completely unaware that one is a carrier, and so that creates a certain kind of real and present danger, I think, to borrow that term. I think that was Tom Clancy's book. It actually was turned into a pretty decent movie with Harrison Ford. If you're looking for something while you're being quarantined. So a little side shot there. Well, what about this, though? So there's a kind of one of those tensions that you were talking about, and this is maybe where subsidiary can help, is that there does seem to be, there may be a need given, again, sort of the nature of the virus, that you can be a carrier, you not know it, transmitting it to others, not being aware of it. In order to protect us from each other, there's going to be some funding for a variety, something like 50 testing stations to be set up around the state of Indiana. And then that raises the question, and I'm not clear yet, because I need to look into a little bit more as of the the recording of this program. But, you know, so what about mandatory? So for set aside vaccinations, we don't really don't even have one yet. What about mandatory testing? And then by the state requiring it, and then the state requiring you to reveal who you've been in contact with, because you may have infected them. You may have exposed them to the virus. What sort of concerns, if any, or considerations might that raise for you? Because I have a few.
You know, from a Catholic moral standpoint, so looking at kind of what the church kind of is saying we should be concerned about, you know, I can definitely see some issues of around the dignity of a person being trampled on because they've tested negative to this, and so suddenly you're treated like a second or third class citizen because you've tested positive. On the flip side, you know, I do think as a Catholic you have an obligation to test yourself, be tested, avoid contact with other people if you are in fact a carrier of a disease that could make other people sick. That is a moral obligation, and we as Catholics need to take that very seriously. And so, you know, I think that really it's best left at the level of families and of how to deal with this, how best to implement this. But, you know, let's face it, human nature being what it is, there are going to be some families and some individuals that don't follow up with their obligations, and then they become a danger to the public. I do see cities and communities having a responsibility to a certain extent of policing that. You start getting up above that, and you've got a duty to report back to some centralized authority of who you've been in contact with and who you've talked to. Yeah, I think you're starting to get into the realm of being, I think, infringing on people's dignity as a human being, of having no privacy, of having to report to other people who you've been talking to, where you've been going, who you've been consorting with. That I see a lot of potentials for abuse with that. So I would, you know, that would be one where I would caution for people to tread lightly on this whole idea of reporting back to a centralized authority so that they can follow up on all of your contacts and who you've been in contact with.
Well, I know law enforcement already. Yeah, I see that as problematic too. You know, law enforcement already can obtain a warrant compelling cell phone carriers to release specific location data to them. So in cases where, say a crime's been committed, but there's no witnesses, there's no video camera. And so, but you know the crime's been committed. You want to find out like who was, and you have an idea of location and you have a specific time frame in mind. Law enforcement can go to a court and get a warrant and then compel the cell phone carriers to release location data to see who, what cell phones were at that date and time that you're interested in trying to find suspects. And so that's already happening. So it would seem to me a logical, if there was enough desire on the part of, say, authorities, given, again, say, from a public health and safety standpoint, to say, hey, look, we know human beings spread this stuff through contact. We need to begin to track people with or without their consent, with or without their knowledge, perhaps. I'm not saying they have to start there, but maybe they would seek consent and knowledge first, but maybe not. Maybe not restrict themselves to that. If the danger to public health and safety is great enough, why not engage in something like location tracking and to pull big data, you know, and then going even a step further, and this has been speculated about in a lot of different circles, is why rely on just cell phones? Not everyone has a cell phone or a cell phone that's equipped with sufficient technology for that kind of location information, but move more into a chip, have some sort of chip that someone would either be required to carry and have on their person at all times, or we would want to perhaps use invasive technology and embed the chip in them. So
a lot of that sounds like that would definitely be violating, you know, the dignity of the individual. That the church, you know, teaches hard and works hard to protect that dignity. So, you know, I would find that to be pretty problematic. We're coming up on a break, so when we come back, I think maybe we should talk a little bit about chips and enhancement. What do you think, Tim?
Sounds good.
All right, and we'll be back with more of the Catholic Cave right after this.
Have you been married and have since divorced? Do you think your marital status prevents you from coming to church? Most Catholics and non-Catholics unfortunately have a lot of misconceptions about marriage, divorce, and remarriage. Pope Francis has recently encouraged all people with questions about marriage to make an appointment and talk with their parish priest. As Catholic priests, we look forward to the opportunity to help you on your journey through life. Please make an appointment to speak with the priest today. We are and will always be here for you.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Kent Blanford in my cave. Timothy O'Donnell's in his cave, and Mark Tuttle's in his cave. And gentlemen, the subject was brought up just before the break when we were talking about being able to track someone and know where they are and what they're doing and those kinds of things. And, you know, can that technology be implanted and, you know, like a chip in someone's body or whatever? And, guys, I got to tell you, it's not anything new. I've had a pacemaker for a little over 2 years now. It has a device in it that reports my heart condition and my status to my doctor's office once a week. It's downloading information on me. I'm being tracked already. As a matter of fact, a few months ago, my sodium level got way too high. I was taking on too many fluids and this kind of thing. My pacemaker picked that up and my doctor's office called me to tell me about it. So this technology is already out there to be tracking people and knowing what's going on with them and knowing what's going on with their bodies. So the question I have is, you know, how far do we go with this? I mean, this is honestly, you know, I'm fine with it. It's for my good. It keeps me alive, keeps my heart going. If my heart stops, it's going to shock me back into life, I hope. But, you know, where do we go with these kinds of devices? And, you know, are they, you know, acceptable for us to use long-term down the road for more than just keeping someone alive and tracking their health?
Yeah, I think you bring up a very important qualification to what we're talking about, and that is, you know, a lot of this technology, there are very ethical, good uses for. Your heart and your pacemaker and it's sending data back to your doctor, I think that's a perfect example of why and where subsidiarity comes into this. You know, you sharing information with a doctor that you've contracted with to take care of your health, who has an understanding of confidentiality about your health, makes perfect sense. You've got a closed loop of information going on there. You know, if you've got that information to restrict you from, let's say, the airlines don't want liability of having people with pacemakers flying on their airplanes, so they want to have that data at their fingertips so that they can restrict people from getting on and off their airplanes because they think that's going to add liability for them to have people with pacemakers on their planes, that would be a misuse of that data and it would be a misuse of that technology. So, you know, the technology itself isn't always problematic, but how it's used and especially when you're talking about technology that's sharing information, how and where and what level and what the reaction to the information is, that's really what makes all the ethical difference in the world.
Yeah, I would say, yeah, I agree. I think some of the things that are part of your current situation, Kent, and I am so glad you brought up, it's a great example, is one, you consented to it, and two, you trust that the doctor in their office is interested in preserving your life and what's best for you, and that they're going to follow and protect the confidentiality of the data that they're receiving. But you can also pretty easily imagine, again, if when the fear factor is very high, it could be, you know, that those things could shift or change. So for example, like Mark was saying, yeah, what if an airline didn't want to take that risk? Or maybe an interim step would be an airline might say, well, your health condition presents more risk to us, so there's a surcharge. So we're going to charge you more to access our airline because of something that we know about you, because of what the technology's gathered from you and has now been shared. Also imagine if that, rather than just a commercial enterprise, what if we found ourselves, say, in the state of Indiana, where euthanasia was legalized, and where in addition, so no longer was your doctor limited to simply looking out for, preserving your health and extending your life. But what if they actually also had a secondary duty to make in their judgment when your quality of life has failed to meet a certain standard, and they turn your box off and you're done. Now, what about that?
I want to toss one out for you, because last week there was a blanket order that was issued in the state of New York that EMTs and paramedics were not to resuscitate anyone. It was a blanket do not resuscitate order. So if they found someone in the field who was in cardiac arrest, they were told not to resuscitate. Now, that was eventually overturned and removed. But there for a while, I mean, here you had EMTs who were going out on the scene. Someone's lying there. They know that they have a device in their hands that they can use to shock this person back to life, but they're told not to use it.
Yeah, because the person's too dangerous, right? Yeah. Because of risk of infection or exposure.
Well, no.
Yeah, absolutely.
That wasn't the issue. Yeah. Well, the issue was simply that there were too many people in hospitals. They didn't want to have to send this critically ill person into a hospital.
So it's like
kind of there's the capacity issue. Yeah, that's another reason. Yeah. Well, here's one that was going on, before this pandemic happened, and that was in Belgium. I don't think it got passed yet, but it wouldn't surprise me. Belgium is really ground zero for euthanasia anyway. And believe me, euthanasia is really getting some strong legs in this pandemic. Here's what they were considering. Belgium was considering terminating providing health care for anyone over the age of 80, because it was thought, because why? Healthcare is expensive. People at that age usually are large consumers of healthcare, so there's a lot of economic incentive. Their quality of life is quote unquote low. So once you turn 80 years old, the law that was written, it wasn't passed yet, but was written, is that no, once you hit 80, they won't kill you, but you're no longer going to get access to state provided healthcare. Right. So you're kind of on your own. Well, at that age, of course, you're vulnerable. You're not going to make it very long. So there's all kinds of things that can emerge. And once you have once you have technology in you, you have what you described in the state of New York, there's a kind of vulnerability that's now present. And we hope that it wouldn't, and we'd have to take means to hope that it wouldn't be used against you or anyone else.
Yeah, I think the misuse of the information as information technology gets more and more developed, the misuse of it becomes a graver concern. You know, I think the pacemaker and the distinction between a pacemaker and, let's say, a chip that is going to give information about your health for social reasons, I think that leads to a huge distinction too, that, you know, the purpose of the pacemaker and the purpose of the information going back to your doctor is to preserve and enhance your health. The purpose of a chip being planted in somebody's hand to track a disease or an epidemic, that's being used for social reasons. That's being used to, you know, try to cut back on the spread of the disease to other people. And, you know, I think there's a pretty large distinction between medicine, which is there to help and enhance a person's health, and, you know, social, to a certain extent, social restrictions to keep people from intermingling and mixing where they might be a potential health risk to other people.
Yeah, I mean, there's already, it reminded me, I never used it because it wasn't available when my kids were younger. You know, there are features, there's apps, right, on smartphones where you can, you have to enable it, but there's location, right? So you can, tracking, so you can enable, say, as a parent, your kids have a certain age, say, have a smartphone. Well, you can pull up, you put on your app, and you can see exactly where their smartphone is, which is presumably on them. So you can see where they're at. So getting a chip, though, could mean it have a lot of different implications, as we were talking about. Like, you can't enter a certain store unless your chip demonstrates that you have the requisite qualifications, which may include something like a vaccine, that you've been vaccinated, something like that. There's all sorts of things, and that you know, there's passive where it has to be read by another device, or there's kind that could give off signals, right, like your cell phone does. Those are all anyway. I don't get too far down the road on that one, but it is coming up in terms of more and more questions about, with say invasive technology or technology in general, you know, when have we gone too far?
Yeah, well, the use of the information is already out there. I know Australia is talking about utilizing cell phones and cell phone data to track people and allow or not allow them to go certain places based on whether they've been tested recently, antibody testing, etc. Everybody's being encouraged to download a coronavirus tracking app. So that's going on in Australia, and I know in Germany they're talking about mandatory testing and a health certificate, so that you've got basically a health passport saying that you've tested, you know, negative for coronavirus to be able to go to work, go shopping, be out in public, etc. So it's not using invasive technology, but it's using the same information in ways to, you know, either, depending on how you look at it, protect the common good and protect the body politic, or to, you know, in ways that would be, I guess, injurious to the dignity of a human person by sort of restricting your freedom to go places and your freedom to access, you know, shops and places like that.
Well, there's going to be a lot more conversations about this, you know, here in the Catholic Caves and other places. You know, I would say, you know, a great resource to read up more about anything pertaining to Catholic bioethics is the National Catholic Bioethics Center. They have a lot. They actually have a COVID-19 section, a lot of great free information, articles, things like that. And then they also have a great selection of different books and shorter articles that they also sell. So fantastic resource there. Highly recommend visiting that.
Yeah, and I would also add to that, you know, since we're in quarantine and we all have a little bit of extra time on our hands, reading through the first part of the second part of the Summa. You know, if you have a little bit of time on your hands and you've got access to maybe not the whole Summa, but maybe you've got the Summa of the Summa that's come out, or you've got all sorts of other publications that are paraphrasing or giving the Summa in a little bit more readable format. The first part of the second part, the beginning, the first, I want to say probably 40 to 50 questions in there have to do with ethics and the dignity of the human person and how we're constituted as people and what our moral obligations are to protect one another.
And we are going to continue to protect one another by staying home until such time as it's deemed appropriate for us to return to our studios, to our work, to our churches. And so, for Timothy O'Donnell, for Mark Tuttle, I'm Kent Blandford. This has been The Catholic Cave on Catholic Radio Indy. Be safe.
The Catholic Cave is a production of Catholic Radio Indy. Replays of this program are available in podcast form at catholicradioindy.org. Comments about this program can be addressed to kent@catholicradioindy.org or by calling 317-870-8400. Did you miss something in this show or just want to hear it again? Podcasts of this and all our other great local programs are available 24/7 at catholicradioindy.org.